everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, we've got some great winter warmers to curl up with. Rachel Ward introduces us to Ant and Bee, amateur sleuths who work in a supermarket by day and investigate murders by night.
All life passes through a supermarket, and there's so much potential for plots and stories. Everybody who walks through the door has got a story.
We'll be previewing a great, accessible Harry Potter exhibition in the British Library.
It centres around the Hogwarts subject, so that's potions, alchemy, herbology, charms, astronomy, divination, defence against the dark arts and magical creatures.
Peter Kenny demonstrates just how versatile you have to be an RNIB narrator.
And of course, I've done the books totally in his voice, or at least an approximation, so folk can sort of hear his syntax.
Listener Kevin Beesting reviews a couple of great novels, and we reveal the Costa 2017 Book of the Year. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Rachel Ward is a best-selling author of young adult fiction. Her debut, Numbers and its sequels, took readers into an apocalyptic near future. Now she's turned her hand to crime fiction with The Cost of Living. Set around a supermarket in the suburbs of Bristol, it's a warm, funny and well-observed page-turner that's packed with quirky customers. And here to tell us more is the author. Rachel Ward, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
I've introduced the book, but could you give us a little bit more of the plot of The Cost of Living?
Well, The Cost of Living is a cosy crime story set in and around a supermarket. So I invented a supermarket called Cost Save, and my main character is a very smart checkout girl called Bee, and she is outraged, really, when one of her fellow workers is attacked on the way home from work, and she wants to investigate and keep the streets of Kingsley safe.
Cost Save is very much at the centre of the book. In fact, it's very much a community centre. It's a suburb of Bristol, isn't it? All the locals.
It's sort of Keynsham, which is a market town between Bristol and Bath. And I worked there for 10 years for the local council, and so I'm kind of drawing on that when I'm writing about it, yeah.
And did you spend much time in an Asda or a Morrison's observing what went on?
Well, I've realised I spent a lot of time in supermarkets, and, you know, for the last 30 years, we all do it, don't we? We do our weekly shop or now a daily shop, maybe, and I've sort of been absorbing it all. And I realised a few years ago that everybody has to shop for food. So all life passes through a supermarket. And there's so much potential for plots and stories. Everybody who walks through the door has got a story.
It seems so obvious when you read it, but actually it felt so fresh. And there's a wonderful warmth and observation that flows through the book. It's, as you say, it's cosy, but it's not the sort of normal in-your-face police procedural crime story.
Yeah.
It feels like it could happen next door.
Yes, well, that's very much what I wanted it to be. I mean, it's a very contemporary story, so it's not sort of sickly sweet cosy. I want it to be fairly realistic and yet feel familiar. You know, it could be your local supermarket that you go to every week. And I wanted that kind of warm feel to it, even though it's a crime story. So it's funny getting that balance, actually. It's quite difficult getting the balance. And when I started out writing it, I wasn't sure what sort of story it was going to be or what age range, actually, I was writing for, whether it was an adult book or a young adult book, because that's what I've written before. But as I started writing it, it kind of just almost wrote itself, and it turned into an adult book. But with a lovely sort of warm feel and a cast of characters who feel like friends, at least to me.
They certainly come across that way. I saw that you describe yourself as an author of thrillers for young adults and crime stories for adults. Where do you think the line between those two lies?
That's quite a tricky one. I think with a young adult, the focus is normally almost entirely on a young adult or teenage protagonist, and usually you're seeing things through their eyes. So my young adult ones, I've mostly written in the first person, so you're experiencing the story through their eyes. With this adult book, although my protagonists are both quite young, Ant and B are both sort of 19, 20-ish, I'm telling it in the third person, so I'm telling the story. And they've got a wide cast of characters around them who also have, you know, their own parts to play. And so it's not a coming-of-age story. It's one step on from that, and the focus is different.
And you've mentioned Ant, who is B's partner in crime solving. He's a very plausible, rather engaging former young offender.
I absolutely love Ant, yes. I mean, at first glance, you know, you might think he's a bit gormless and a bit of a loser, but actually it turns out, you know, he's got contacts, he's got sort of street smarts, he's actually very kind, and he develops this lovely friendship with Bea. And as they investigate the mystery, you can see their friendship growing. And it was such a lovely thing to write.
And as much as it is a crime story, it is fundamentally about friendships and relationships and trust.
Mm. Yes, and it is about friendships, it's about family relationships, and even the sort of family that exists at Cossave. It's the family of workers there, and how the community sort of uses the shop and feels part of something.
You clearly feel quite strongly about the fracturing of communities.
I do. And I mean, maybe I'm writing a slightly idealised version of the world or how I would like it to be. I think it's probably realistic in some places. And it's certainly how I would like the world to be, where you sort of look out for your neighbours, and if somebody's in distress, you try and help and all that sort of stuff. Maybe it is a little bit idealised, but, you know, I would really like to think that's how we can live.
Well, it's certainly refreshing to read a book where people aren't in each other's faces arguing all the time. They're actually having conversations and working through problems rather than the dramatic and often very bloody crime stories that seem to be the diet that fills most of the shelves.
Yes, I mean, I read a lot of crime. In fact, the last 2 years, I've pretty much read solid crime. And I can't bring myself to read the very violent stuff. And there's also a lot of very sort of twisted psychological type crime thrillers. So I can read some of them, but it was actually such a relief to write a book that's essentially warm-hearted. And I hope there's a room for that it's a big crime market, it's a huge market, but I do hope there's room for books at my end of the scale, as well as all the others.
I certainly find crime stories more psychologically affecting if I can imagine that they might actually happen rather than some of the rather convoluted plots that we get nowadays.
Mm.
The names Ant and Bea obviously have a resonance for those of us who were growing up in the 1970s. It is presumably a nod to Angela Banner's books that taught so many of us how to read.
Absolutely, yes. I'm a little bit older than you, so I grew up in the 60s. And I remember those. And you can still actually buy the Ant and Bea books, and Ant and Bea Around the World and all that sort of stuff. It's definitely a nod to that. And when I was thinking of names, actually names for characters are quite difficult and they're so important. So I played about with names for a long time, but I settled on B quite quickly. And then I was just so pleased when I realised you could have an ant to team up with.
And rather like the original Ant and B, Ant is rather adventurous and maybe a little bit impetuous at times, and B is more cautious and thoughtful.
Yes, she's cautious and thoughtful. She's quite resourceful. Mm. Yes, I mean, readers of the old Ant and B will be happy to know there's a kind dog in the next book.
Wonderful. And
Anton Bee's names also, you reveal early on in the book, have a more recent history.
Yes, they do. Bee is named after Princess Beatrice, and Ant is named after Tony Blair. So, and that's one of the ways they bond quite quickly, is that the interesting choices their parents made when they were naming them.
Yes, it's they've certainly shortened their own names to get away from their name gangers, I suppose.
Yes, can't blame them.
And you mentioned that there's a sequel on the way. How far through that are you?
Well, I've written a first draft of a sequel. I've got quite a few plots in my mind, so I really hope I can write Ant and Bee stories for years and years. But at the moment, I've got the first draft of a sequel. I need to do some edits on that. And then I'm already sort of buzzing with ideas for a third book. So I'm sort of all fired up and ready to go with it. So, hopefully this is the start of a decent series.
Well, I can't wait. And what was lovely for me was to find that it was published simultaneously as an audiobook, which is beautifully read by Charlie Sanderson.
Yeah.
Did you have any input into choosing her as the narrator?
Well, they sent me a sample of her voice just to check out. I was happy, and I really was. So it was simply a case of, yes, please. And she does read it really beautifully.
I believe there's a bit of family history as far as making books accessible to readers with sight loss.
Yes, there is. In fact, there are two sort of nuggets of information on this one. My dad used to volunteer to mend the tape recorders of people with visual impairments with the, I don't know if it's still called talking books or talking newspapers.
It's talking books and talking newspapers, yeah.
Well, this was probably in the 70s, so I think they were probably cassette players rather than reel-to-reel, whatever.
Huge volumes.
Yes, yes. So he used to do that because he's an engineer by training, and that was his sort of way of volunteering and helping out. So that's a lovely link, actually, and it sort of reinforces for me how important audiobooks are. And I'm so pleased that The Cost of Living is available as an audiobook. The other sort of story about this is that The Cost of Living came to life as a sort of audiobook, because I read it out to my husband chapter by chapter when he was very ill in hospital. So he had a heart transplant a couple of years ago. And to start with, he was at home and I would send it to him chapter by chapter on his Kindle, and I could hear him laughing at the right places in another room, which was excellent. And then he was admitted to hospital to wait for his transplant. And then through the magic of the internet, I could still send chapters to his Kindle and we could discuss them when I went to visit. And then he was extremely ill after his transplant and in intensive care for 5 months. And I had a little break from writing when it was all kicking off. And then I went back to writing and I read the book chapter by chapter to him while he was in intensive care. He couldn't escape, so I had a captive audience. But it was a lovely thing because it gave us something other than all the medical trauma we were both going through. So we had this story to sort of keep us going, really. And it was just ridiculously emotional when we got to the end. I couldn't read the last last couple of paragraphs out, so I just sort of held it up in front of his face, and he had to read it himself because I couldn't get the words out. But that, again, sort of stressed to me how important stories are to people and what a lovely thing it is to read a story and to be read to. Yeah, definitely. I'm very pleased that more people can listen to The Cost of Living as well as read it.
I must say it is one of the best listens that I've had for many months. It's beautifully read. And I wonder, maybe did you find that you were writing it or editing it in a slightly different way, knowing that it was going to be read out loud? And do you now read your work back to yourself out loud?
Ooh, that's a very good question. I no, not consciously. I didn't write it in a different way consciously, but this is the first book that I've ever sent to my husband chapter by chapter. With my other books, I've written the whole thing and then I've shown him a first draft. It's a funny... I don't know why we did it like that. I think, actually, I was so excited when I was writing it that I wanted to share it. So I showed him the first few chapters and then we just carried on. And also because it was, you know, it's the sort of book that, it has this crime thread, but it does make you laugh as well. And it was just such a nice thing to share. So it just seemed obvious to carry on sharing chapter by chapter.
I'm certainly looking forward to sharing it with friends and family and to hearing the sequel. And I'm delighted that you've been able to share it with our listeners on Read On. Rachel Wood, thank you so much for coming into the studio and being a guest on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely.
She ran the items through the till and took the cash while Aunt started cleaning up. "There we are," she said, handing Julie her change. "No harm done." B smiled, and Julie managed a watery smile back. "Thank you," she said. She put Mason down again and made him hold onto the trolley, and they set off for the exit. B watched her go, then turned her attention to Ant, who was slopping soapy water around the floor with the mop. After a minute, he ground to a halt, holding the mop with both hands and leaning his chin on top. "You need to put your triangle out now," said B. "The wet floor one." "Okay, on it." But he didn't move. "I'm knackered," he said. "Don't know if I can hack this." "Shh, not in front of the customers. Go and empty that bucket in the drain outside." "Yeah, right," he said. He found the yellow warning cone and shambled off, leaving a good-sized puddle on the floor behind him. When he'd gone, Bee clasped her hands together, then turned them inside out, stretched and cracked her knuckles. "Don't reckon he'll make it to Friday," she said to Dot. "Oh, don't be harsh. It's his first day. Remember yours?"
Charlie Sanderson narrating The Cost of Living, written by my guest Rachel Wood. The Cost of Living and many of Rachel Ward's other books, including Numbers, are available for sale as audiobooks.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
I think the whole talking book scheme, in whatever form it is absolutely fantastic.
Joanna Trollope on the RNIB Talking Book Service.
I think in this day and age, modern medicine is so clever and so sophisticated, and we spend an enormous amount of time and energy and enthusiasm saving lives. But what the talking books do and what the RNIB, I think, does in general is save sanities before you know you get to the end of your life. The number of people whose lives have been transformed by talking books. I mean, the number of people who are visually impaired or blind who say that their lives have been absolutely changed. This is a lifeline. It's impossible to emphasise how important that is.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's compendium of the best in books. Still to come in this week's show, a pair of great book reviews from our old friend Kevin Beesting. And we'll announce the winner of the Costa Book of the Year Award 2017. But first, Peter Kenny has narrated more than 30 books for RNIB. Many listeners will know him best for his work on Paul O'Grady's autobiographies. As we'll hear, he was ideally suited to give voice to the creator of Lily Savage. But he's also narrated many novels, including those of Ian Banks, Jonas Jonasson and Michael Morpurgo. He told RNIB reporter Claire Carson how he came to Talking Books. But first, here's a clip of him in action narrating Paul O'Grady's autobiography, At My Mother's Knee and Other Low Joints.
At home, I've got a box containing what I suppose you might call the family archives. Family archives sounds very grand, but it's actually just an ordinary cardboard box containing an assortment of birth certificates, letters, old diaries and sepia photographs. The flotsam and jetsam of lives past. There's even a pair of yellowing false teeth wrapped up in a handkerchief. God knows who they belong to. It could have been any one of my long-dead forebears. When I was growing up in Birkenhead, nearly every adult I knew had false teeth, or at least had a couple of fake choppers on a dental plate. Either that, or no teeth at all. My mother, christened Mary but known to everyone as Molly, had every tooth in her head extracted when false teeth became available on the National Health. She came from a generation where a poor diet and only the most primitive dental hygiene had taken its toll on working-class teeth. Therefore, a set of gleaming white gnashers, courtesy of the NHS, was a highly desirable acquisition.
That was Peter Kenny narrating, and welcome to the studio, Peter.
Hello there. Or actually, perhaps I should do my own voice. Hello there, this is Peter Kenny.
Yes, who have we got here in the studio with us? Peter, you've narrated so many books for RNIB. We were trying to add up, and we think we've got to around 30. How did it all start? Where did the journey begin?
Well, I was an actor on the BBC Radio Drama Company, 93-94. And whilst I was there, I worked a lot with a producer called Matthew Walters, who left the BBC. And subsequently, when I left in 95, I was sitting on a tube and there was Matthew sitting opposite me. And I said, "Oh, hi, Matthew, how are you?" And he said, "I'm great. What are you doing at the moment?" And I said, "Well, this and that and the other." And he said, "You wouldn't have any free time to do audiobooks, would you?" And I went, "Yeah." And he said, "There's no money in it. It's for a charity called Listening Books." I went, "Well, I'd be delighted. Yes, thank you." So I started working for Listening Books, and then there was a wonderful producer there called Ross Berman, who then subsequently came to the RNIB. And Ross brought me with him and said to everybody, "Oh, there's this guy I work with at Listening Books, he's really brilliant, get him in." And so I started working for the RNIB, and that would be in about 2004, 2005.
So you've never looked back?
Not at all, and it is my great joy and, delight to do it as well. It's my favourite kind of work.
And many characters and many voices.
More than I can possibly remember.
I've already detecting there was a Liverpudlian origin and a Scottish past.
I was born in Scotland, and my parents moved to Liverpool when I was about three. So I grew up on Merseyside. My parents are Irish as well, so there's a nice Celtic melange to kind of mix in. So.
Tell us about Paul O'Grady.
Paul O'Grady, of course, is a fantastic, a very popular figure on television and radio. And I was asked to do his autobiographies when they were printed, published. And of course, I've done the books totally in his voice, or at least an approximation, so folk can sort of hear his syntax, because it's written very much in his voice. The way he writes them, you know. And that accent is kind of the accent I grew up with as a kid. His mother went to the same UCM, which is the Union of Catholic Mothers, as my mother. And he was taken, there's a bit in the book where they're taken to Pantasseth, which is this place in North Wales, a place of pilgrimage. And I spent most of my summer holidays going to Pantasseth, because that's what you did when you were a Catholic kid growing up on Merseyside. You know, that's just the way it was. So we almost probably knew each other as kids, but he lived about 3 miles away and I never actually met him until much later in life.
So how do you get on with Lily Savage?
Well, Lily's great. She's an extraordinarily broad, ballsy sort of character. She's a divorcee living on a tough life on Merseyside. And she's based very closely on various women in his childhood, his aunts, who are incredible figures and had a huge impact on him as a person.
And do you really get under the character of the book that you're reading? So as the narrator, do you really get into Paul O'Grady's mind as a 12-year-old lost his father?
In order to do justice to any book, regardless of whether it's an autobiography or whether it's fiction, the narrative voice is very personal to the author. And as an interpreter of the book, a reader of the book for listeners, you have to kind of get inside that and be very truthful to it. You can't bring anything from outside. If you do, it stands out like a sore thumb and people really object to it. It's like, what's that doing there? Why is that voice there or whatever? You have to be guided what's in the text. It's very, very important.
Talking about Catholic, you seem to have a very Catholic ability to narrate a wide range of books. I think you've done 23 out of 28 Ian Banks.
That's correct.
How did you find him?
Well, again, actually, that kind of came through by this Ross Berman, who worked at the RNIB, because after he left the RNIB to work in the commercial sector, he started working for a company called Strathmore, who used to audio publish Ian Banks' books. And Ross said, there was this guy at the RNIB who I worked with who's good and I think he'd be great. So he got me into there as well. And so the first book of his I recorded was The Steep Approach to Garbadale, which was the first book he'd written in about 8 years because he took a break in the middle of his career. And that was a success. So they asked me to do The Wasp Factory, which Sue Arnold kind of was very, very kind about. And subsequently, that's it. I did all his books thereafter, bar one, which I wasn't available for. So, which was a great privilege, and I love his writing, and I have to say we all miss him terribly.
Mm. Do you have a favourite of the books that you've narrated?
Of all the books, or of his specifically?
I mean, all the books.
Of all the books, golly gosh. Well, actually, one of my favourites was a book I recorded at the RNIB here, which is by Willie Russell. It's called The Wrong Boy, which is an absolutely hilarious and tragic read at the same time. It's one of those books, it's a real page-turner, and you can be laughing your head off on one page and sobbing on the next one. It's so well written. I mean, Willie Russell is a magician with that sort of thing. But it is. There are scenes in that of comedy which I will never forget. They're so strong in my mind.
Mm. And a beautiful connection, because a genius behind the recording here actually recorded you, if I'm correct, in the first book that he ever recorded, which was...
The Wrong Boy. Yeah, I think it was Richard who's doing the recording here now. Richard produced me on that and was very gentle with me.
And your first book was a... absolute showstopper.
I was astonished to be asked to record it. It was Revolution Day by Raghi Omar, his account of the fall of Baghdad. An incredibly powerful book. Again, I can still remember very distinct images and passages from that book, which will never leave me, because the way he depicted his experience from inside. He was inside Baghdad as the West was attacking from the outside, because he, as a Muslim and an Arabic speaker, he was allowed inside with the press. So he witnessed it from the inside, which is extraordinary.
So I'm hearing a fantastic ability to get inside the book and the author. But you as a person, how do you... take time out from that intensity? Do you have things that you love doing?
I'm an avid walker, and I love to ski as well. So I have those sort of things on my side. And I do love long walks. Like this year I walked from Glasgow to Inverness with my brother.
Goodness.
And partner. We 200 miles in 14 days. It was marvellous. And spectacular weather as well. I was very lucky.
Wow, and singing, I'm sure, is in there somewhere.
Well, as an actor, because before I moved into audio, I used to do a lot of theatre. I used to work for the Royal Shakespeare Company, and I toured with various other companies. That's the curse of the audio studio. My tummy rumble. But there we go. That's a real live example of the things that shouldn't happen in an audio studio. But, I used to sing a lot, particularly with the RSC, because I was a countertenor. And particularly, I was actually a male soprano. I could hit up the top C quite happily. Not these days, but I could when I was a little bit younger.
And what next? Have you got books that you've really desperate to narrate, or unfinished business?
Ooh,
what's the unfinished business?
Well, the unfinished business is the book I'm in the middle of. I'm recording here at the RNIB a book called The Lion of Macedon by David Gemmell. It's part of a two-book series. The second book is The Dark Prince, and they'll be coming out, I think, later this year. And
I suppose for me, the next book is always the most exciting one, or the one I'm working on is the most exciting one, because you, just to take you back to what you're saying about, you know, being able to get alongside the books, I think for anyone doing audiobook recordings, you have to have a strong sense of empathy. You've got to be able to empathise with anybody, because even if the book is written from the perspective of a villain, you can't play them as mwahaha all the way through. Otherwise, where's the journey? So everyone has a reason for doing the things they do, and you've got to be able to find that in order to play them fairly. So,
Peter Kenny, thank you so much for joining us. Can you just do us a voice? Or teach me a voice before you leave. I can't bear to let you go without understanding.
Okay. Well, a character voice journey, very, very quickly, is there was a book I recorded for Mark Lawson last year, called The Allegations. And there's a character in it and throughout the book you get little clues. You're not told the person is this right from the start. You slowly have to pick up the clues from the text to build the character. So when we first meet him, we're told that he's a very dull bureaucrat who talks incredibly slowly and rather ponderously and is rather pleased with the sound of his own voice. But then we found out that he's actually from Northern Ireland, so he has to be somebody from Northern Ireland who speaks very slowly and very ponderously. And then we find out that he's actually in his late 60s, early 70s, so perhaps we want to age up the voice a little to make it just a little bit older sounding, as is this ponderous man, who then we find out speaks with a wheeze, so he not only has that, he speaks with a wheeze as well, and so he starts to talk like that, and then the final bit of the ingredient is that he also has a slight whistle, so sometimes when he's speaking, his voice has this whizzy whistle in it as well.
So that's how that character was built.
How incredible. Thank you so much, Peter, for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure. Lovely to meet you, Claire. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard too.
Thanks to Peter Kenny and Claire Carson. For more information about the books he's narrated in the RNIB Library, visit the website rniblibrary.com or phone the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, the book that Costa Award judges considered the best of 2017, and the novels that Rachel Ward chose as the books of her life. But before that, loyal listener and longtime friend of the show, Kevin Beesting, is Britain's best-loved blind book reviewer. As you know, here at Read On, we're always keen to hear about the titles that you've been enjoying. And so, Kevin shared a couple of his most recent reads with us.
The Kite Runner by Khaled Hosseini. Afghanistan, from the 1960s onwards. The fictional story of a boy growing up in colonial-style Kabul. Amir was never able to match up to his father's expectations. That is, until the city's renowned kite tournament. But after that day of the tournament, his life was never going to be the same again. He was trafficked out of the country, still a boy, but destined later in life to return to a very different Kabul. A fascinating, sometimes poignant, sometimes brutal insight into a country ravaged by wars, with a refugee who manages to rebuild his life far away, but deep down knows he has left something important behind. This book is so hard to put down, as it vividly looks at ways of life so different from our own. Or are they so different? Packed with controversy, racial divides, schoolboy pranks and power-crazed despots. A book I would recommend to anyone who loves a good page-turner. I first came across the narrator, David Thorpe, when he read the audio versions of radio presenter Red Sails' works. The Kite Runner must have been particularly difficult, but the inflections were perfect and the accents amazing. He is definitely among my top three favourite narrators.
The Kite Runner by Khaled Hosseini is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB14879. Kevin also reviewed the great Russian classic War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy.
The greatest novel ever written, a phrase often used when discussing War and Peace, but how many people manage reading it to the end? If a book that size seems a bit daunting, then listening to it on audiobook from RNIB Overdrive is an ideal alternative. You can listen to it while doing housework or gardening, travelling, at the gym, in the bath, at bedtime, or even curled up on the settee with the telly turned off. The story is set at the time of Napoleon's invasion of the Russian Empire, and begins at a grand soiree, which introduces us to many of the main characters. Soon after, the battles commence, and the vastly experienced French push through the unprepared and often inept home forces. The patience, grit, and determination of the Russians, however, prevail in the end. An in-depth but fascinating study of historical adventures, love stories, and social attitudes from a different country. This is an epic classic not to be missed. Why not give it a go?
War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy is available in Braille and as TB1374. Thanks as ever to Kevin Beesting. Keep up the great work. And if you'd like to read more of Kevin's reviews, you can follow his blog on blindkevindogspence.blogspot.co.uk. Do you have a book that you'd like to review? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
Hello, I'm David Thorpe, and I've been reading for the RNIB Talking Books for 13 years. One of my favourite books was Sue Townsend's Adrian Mole and the Weapons of Mass Destruction. It's been my great privilege to read many brilliant books for the RNIB, but this is a particular favourite of mine. Adrian Mole is a character who has been with me all my life. He's roughly the same age as me. And to reacquaint myself with him, both for Adrian Mole, the Cappuccino years, and in particular Adrian Mole and the Weapons of Mass Destruction, was a great delight, and also led to me meeting Sue Townsend, which of course was another great pleasure. Adrian Mole is 34 and three quarters, almost officially middle-aged, living in a minimalist loft apartment and working in an antiquarian bookshop. Despite finding solace in a literary life, Adrian is worried about the pathetic slide towards gum disease, wheelchair ramps and death, about whether or not he can get a refund on his holiday to Cyprus, about his engagement to flaky New Ager marigold flowers, and about his failure to find a celebrity speaker for his writing group's Christmas dinner. I love the books. I think Adrian Mole is a brilliant character. He's on a par for me with something like Sherlock Holmes or Mr. Pickwick. I think he's a fantastic fictional creation. And the books are just laugh-out-loud funny. They're actually quite a challenge as a reader because they're so funny. It's difficult to get through them without laughing yourself. But also that book in particular I found incredibly moving. I won't spoil it for you in case you've not read it, but it's a brilliant, cracking read, and that's one that I really enjoyed. I had to wait 10 minutes outside the shop. Mr. Carlton Hayes had trouble finding a parking space. I watched him walk up the high street. He looked as if he was on his last legs. I don't know how much longer he can carry on with the shop. This is just my luck. He said, "Terribly sorry to keep you waiting, my dear." I took the keys from him and opened the door. Once inside, he leaned against the recent biographies to catch his breath. I said to him, "If we had a few chairs and sofas in here, like I suggested, you could sit down and be comfortable." He said,
"We're not Habitat, Adrian, my dear. We're booksellers."
I said, "Customers expect to be able to sit down in bookshops nowadays, and they also expect a cup of coffee and to be able to visit the lavatory." He said,
"A properly brought up person micturates and defecates and drinks a cup of coffee before they leave their house."
We had the usual quotient of mad people in during the day. A steam train enthusiast with a ginger beard and sellotape spectacles asked me if we had a copy of the 1954 Trans-Siberian timetable in Russian. I showed him our railway section and invited him to search through the mildewed railway ephemera that Mr. Carlton Hayes insists on keeping in stock. Just as we were about to close, a young woman came in and asked if we had a copy of Soft Furnishings for Your Regency Doll's House. I said, "Are you sure such a title exists?" She said that she had once owned a copy, but had lent it to a fellow Doll's House hobbyist who had emigrated to Australia, taking the book with her. I commiserated with her and listed all the books I had loaned over the years and had never seen again. She told me that she had a collection of 18 dolls' houses and that she had made most of the soft furnishings herself, including upholstering the tiny chairs and hanging the tiny curtains. I mentioned that I would need some curtains making when I moved into my new loft apartment and asked her if she'd be interested. She said the longest curtains she had ever made were only 6 inches in length. I love working for the RNIB Talking Book Service, and I think it's a fantastic thing. I suppose it comes really because I love books, and always have done, and I think it's a fantastic service because I can't imagine what life would be like without books, really.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. As regular listeners will know, in recent weeks we've been following the build-up to the Costa Book Awards. After the five category winners were announced, at the beginning of January, judges went away to consider which of them should be crowned Costa Book of the Year 2017. Among those in contention were Gail Honeyman's terrific debut novel, Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine, John McGregor's haunting tale of time and loss, Reservoir 13, which won the Costa Novel Award, Rebecca Stott's frank memoir about growing up in a religious cult, In the Days of Rain, and the winner of the Costa Children's Book of the Year Award, The Explorer by Catherine Rundle. You can hear exclusive interviews with all four of these authors by visiting our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. The Poetry Award was presented posthumously to Helen Dunmore for Inside the Wave and completed a shortlist of great books. But in the end, there can only be one winner, and the result was announced earlier this week. And the title of Costa Book of the Year 2017 goes to Inside the Wave by Helen Dunmore. Helen Dunmore died in June last year, shortly after completing Inside the Wave, her 10th volume of poetry. She was also a highly regarded author of novels and short stories for adults, young adults, and children. Many of the poems included in Inside the Wave deal with her final illness. But while there's sadness, she also celebrates the beauty and quirkiness of life. To be alive is to be inside the wave, always travelling until it breaks and is gone. A wide selection of Helen Dunmore's books is available in a range of formats from the RNIB library, including her Ingo books for young children and her brilliantly chilling ghost story for adults, The Greatcoat, which is TB19910. Inside the Wave should be joining them soon and is available commercially in print and ebook formats. And you can hear Helen Dunmore reading six of her poems by searching online at YouTube. Included in that selection is City Lilacs.
City Lilacs. In crack-haunted alleys, overhangs, plots of sour earth that pass for gardens. In the space between wall and wheelie bin, where men with mobiles make urgent conversation, where bare-legged girls shiver in April winds, where a new mother stands on her doorstep and blinks at the brightness of morning so suddenly born. In all these places, the city lilacs are pushing their cones of blossom into the spring to be taken by the warm wind. Lilac, like love, makes no distinction. It will open for anyone. Even before love knows that it is love, lilac knows it must blossom. In crack-haunted alleys, in overhangs, in somebody's front garden abandoned to crisp packets and cans, on landscape motorway roundabouts, in the depths of parks, where men and women are lost in transactions of flesh and cash, where mobiles ring and the deal is done, here the city lilacs release their sweet, wild perfume, then bow down, heavy with rain.
The late Helen Dunmore, whose final collection of verse, Inside the Wave, has won the 2017 Costa Book of the Year Award.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB News Agent Service, which delivers the latest news, magazines and stories in a range of accessible formats to people with sight loss, is now free for under 16s. Reading can make the world of difference, and it's vital that all blind and partially sighted children can access the same content as their sighted peers in a fun and creative way. Current titles in the RNIB newsagent service include BBC Horrible Histories, First News, Aquila, National Geographic and RNIB Blast Off. Formats include audio CD or USB, email or Braille. To register for RNIB newsagent, please call our helpline on 0303 123 9999 or email us at helpline@rnib.org.uk.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Hocus Pocus Expelleramus. The British Library in central London currently has a very special exhibition on, In Time for Half Term, Harry Potter, A History of Magic. We sent RNIB Connect Radio's Basil Oxterby to speak to one of the co-curators, Joanna Norledge, to find out exactly what it's all about.
So we're really excited about this exhibition. It's a completely fresh look at the Harry Potter stories because we are really delving into the history of the magic that's represented in the Harry Potter stories. So the mythology, the folklore, and the history of all those traditions.
And it's not, so I've just been around, it's not just Harry Potter, as I've said, you're looking into magic throughout the ages, really.
Yes, that's right. And the way that we've structured the exhibition is that it centres around the Hogwarts subject. So that's potions, alchemy, which is actually an advanced subject, you can study at Hogwarts, herbology, charms, astronomy, divination, defence against the dark arts, and magical creatures. And hopefully what the exhibition shows and what Harry Potter fans might not know is that a lot of those subjects have forerunners in history, and our collections, they go back. We've got collection items on display from 3,000 years ago showing the long history of these traditions.
And the reason I'm here today is because it's been made accessible. There are accessible features involved in the exhibition.
Yes, that's right. We have Braille guides available for the exhibition with a selection of the objects and their labels translated. And the Braille guides also include some tactile images of the objects or pages on display from the objects. We've also been running some tours for the visually impaired, which is a first for us at the library. We've not run these before, but yes, we've been building on that. We're also producing an audiobook version of our exhibition catalogue, which is going to be another way that people are going to be able to access our content.
And who are you going to be using to voice this? Are they going to be as magical as Stephen Fry?
There is, I'm afraid it's not been announced yet, so I can't say who it is, but there is a familiar voice narrating that catalogue book, yeah.
How are they received? Have the audio guides and special tours, have they been received by the blind and VI members?
We've had really positive feedback. We have had some advice about how we can make it better, which is wonderful. We'd like to build, as I say, it's the first time we've done this at these tours at the British Library. So being able to get some feedback and make it even better has been really valuable to us.
So why was it, as you've said there, it's the first one, why was it decided that this Harry Potter magic exhibition should be the first that's made accessible to the blind and VI community?
We're well aware of the reach that Harry Potter has around the world, and we felt it really important that our exhibition mirrored that reach and that it was available to as many people as possible.
So are there going to be more accessible exhibitions at the British Library?
Yes, certainly we'll be looking to do more of this type of work.
Were there any difficulties you found whilst trying to make this exhibition accessible?
Yes, there's some hurdles. One of the things, even selecting images to be used for tactile images or to be used in the Braille guide, a lot of our objects are text-based, and so that makes for very, very long braille guides. But the exhibition itself is very visual, has lots of different types of material, so being able to represent all of that also was a difficult. So obviously objects was a much more difficult thing for us to make available for the visually impaired. We do have, for example, we've got the oracle bones, which are these ancient Chinese oracle bones which were used for divination, and we have some 3D model copies made of those. So the tours included a handling session in which people could touch and handle them.
So what was the process in getting these tactile images made? How was it decided that that was going to happen?
That side of it we really left up to our partners at the RNIB. So we used their advice to select images that would be suitable for tactile images. There were some we suggested that they advised wouldn't be possible. And so we were looking for clear images that could be simplified and the different kind of textures and areas signified in a relevant way.
So for anybody that may want to come down, have you got any information that they may need to know, where to pick up the braille guides, who to ask for, anything in particular for our blind and VI listeners?
Yes, so you can pick up the braille guides at the information desk or ask any of our visitor services team and they'll be able to help you.
Joanna Knowledge, thank you very much for talking to us here at RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Basil. Now be sure to jump on your broomstick if you want to visit. The exhibition ends on the 28th of February, but be warned, the tickets are flying out of the window. For more information, go to www.bl.uk/whats-on and follow the links to A History of Magic or call the box office on 01 937 546 546. Now it's back to Rachel Ward for the books of her life. So, Rachel, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you want to become an author?
Well, thinking back, I couldn't think of one. It was more a book of my daughter's childhood that made me want to write, and that was Northern Lights by Philip Pullman. And she read that when she was, 12 or 13, I think. And I read it too, and I was so inspired by the power of his storytelling. And that did inspire me to try writing myself.
They found no gobblers, but the catacombs under the oratory kept Lyra and Roger busy for days. Once, she tried to play a trick on some of the dead scholars by switching around the coins in their skulls so that they were with the wrong demons. Pantalaimon became so agitated at this that he changed into a bat and flew up and down, uttering shrill cries and flapping his wings in her face, but she took no notice. It was too good a joke to waste. She paid for it later, though. In bed in her narrow room at the top of Staircase 12, she was visited by a night ghast and woke up screaming at the three robed figures who stood at the bedside pointing their bony fingers before throwing back their cowls to show bleeding stumps where their heads should have been. Only when Pantalaimon became a lion and roared at them did they retreat, backing away into the substance of the wall until all that was visible was their arms, then their horny yellow-grey hands, then their twitching fingers, then nothing.
Northern Lights by Philip Pullman, narrated by David Thorpe, is TB13475. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread on the sofa?
Well, the book that I keep going back to is The Summer Book by Tove Jansson. She's known for writing The Moomins, but she's written books for adults as well. And The Summer Book is a very small, almost slight book, and it's a story of a girl and her grandma and their summer on an island in the Gulf of Finland, and it's just very delicate and it's got a real sense of place. I like islands, I like coasts, I like sort of being on the edge of things and knowing where I am on the map, and the sense of place is so strong that I can sort of picture myself being there. And although it's a slightly melancholy book, it is a book I go back to.
The Summer Book by Tove Jansson is unfortunately not available in audio, so maybe that's a suggestion if anyone's thinking of making a donation to the RNIB Library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, I've been engrossed in crime for a couple of years. I've been trying to read some different things recently, and I've read a few books over the last few weeks, and the one that really grabbed me was Conclave by Robert Harris, which is about the process to choose a new pope, and it's a sort of thriller set within that closeted conclave, shut away from the world and the drama of what happens. It's completely in a completely alien world to me. I don't really know anything about it, but it's so well written. It completely grips you, and it's just a brilliant read, so I would definitely recommend that.
Cardinal Lomelli left his apartment in the Palace of the Holy Office shortly before 2 in the morning and hurried through the darkened cloisters of the Vatican towards the bedroom of the Pope. He was praying. Oh, Lord, he still has so much to do, whereas all my useful work in your service is completed. He is beloved while I am forgotten. Spare him, Lord, spare him. Take me instead. He toiled up the cobbled slope towards the Piazza Santa Marta. The Roman air was soft and misty, yet already he could detect the first faint chill of autumn. It was raining slightly. The prefect of the papal household had sounded so panicked on the telephone, Lomelli was expecting to be met by a scene of pandemonium. In fact, the piazza was unusually quiet, apart from a solitary ambulance parked a discreet distance away, silhouetted against the floodlit southern flank of St. Peter's. Its interior light was on, the windscreen wipers scudding back and forth, close enough for him to be able to make out the faces of both the driver and his assistant. The driver was using a mobile phone, and Lomelli thought with a shock, they haven't come to take a sick man to the hospital. They've come to take away a body.
Robert Harris's Conclave, narrated by Roy McMillan, which is TB23518. Rachel Ward, thank you for sharing the books of your life with the Read On listeners.
You're welcome, and thank you very much.
Don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All of our past shows are there, complete with exclusive author interviews, book news and reviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.